All right, let's say that I was an atheist and I was talking to you and I started to ask you, why do you believe this Bible that you put your faith in? It's kind of silly for you to believe in it because don't you know that it was written and edited and streamlined and an official version of these events was put together maybe 300 or 400 years after the first century? And these Old Testament prophecies that you put your faith in, don't you know that those were written and made up after the fact, after Jesus lived and died? How might you respond to that accusation?
First of all, they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls that were written way before Jesus Christ even existed, and they were proved to be authentically accurate. And second of all, Jesus Christ was resurrected and witnessed by hundreds of people.
Okay. So Alex appeals back to the witnesses that we have that saw Jesus. Let's zero in on the first thing that he said, the Dead Sea Scrolls. Those were discovered in 1947. And just how far back do they go before Jesus? What's the oldest date that we have for them? Isaiah wrote in 700, but when do the scrolls themselves date to? When were those written? About 100 B.C., 125 B.C., somewhere in there. So if somebody were to tell you that prophecies like Isaiah 53, prophecies like Psalm 22, or Psalm 16, or Psalm 2, that those were made up after the fact, all you have to do is mention the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, in the first century, there was another document that people used at times, and we know from secular history when it was created. And this document was a translation of the Old Testament into another language. And it was translated somewhere between 200 and 250 and 100 BC. What's the name of the text I'm talking about?
Septuagint.
And that was a translation into what language?
Greek.
And why would they translate it into Greek? Did a bunch of Greeks convert to Judaism? That's it. The common tongue of the day, they were now subjects of the Greek Empire. What if somebody told you that the New Testament had not been written until maybe 300 or 400 years after the fact? It was made up centuries later after Jesus lived, if they even acknowledged that he lived. How would you respond to that? Do we have any evidence to the contrary? Okay, so we've got some good sources that John's alluding to that, Lord willing, at a later date we'll talk some more about. I'm talking specifically, how would I know that the text itself was not made up that much later? Do we have any, sir?
It says in Luke 1, chapter 1 and 2, that it was some eyewitnesses.
Okay, Luke does talk about
the beginning were eyewitnesses, okay. Servants of the
work. That's true too, and if we're going to be fair with the internal evidence, we consider that. Matt?
I think the answer you're looking for is
okay, those are good internal evidences that we'll talk about. What about what we discussed?
There's three sources.
Yes.
The manuscript, the quotation, and the version.
Very good.
All dates.
Yes, so consider, for example, on page 13, the oldest manuscript that we have, a portion of John chapter 18. It dates back to when? This would be letter F on number 1, 130 A.D. If you look above that one, letter E, the Chester Beatty Papyri, which is housed in Dublin, Ireland. This contains the four Gospels and the Book of Acts. That's the kernel of the Gospel right there. Dates to when? 150. Are these originals or are they copies? If the copies are showing up in the second century, early second century, what does that tell you about the age of the originals? Older than that, in the first century. We have versions that show up in Egyptian and Latin. We have now documents telling the same story showing up all over the Middle East, all over the Roman Empire, in the various languages of the peoples that make it up. If it's spreading that far and wide, as early as the second or third century, it was told long before that. News travels a lot slower back then than it does now. We have what we call the early Christian writings. How much of the New Testament did these people quote from within the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries?
Enough that all the Testaments of the story actually rewrite them from their quotation.
That's it. Almost 100% of the New Testament. So if every single manuscript was gathered up and burned tomorrow, you could still reconstruct the entire New Testament from the quotations alone. Now let's talk about the internal dating tonight. Jeff referenced Luke chapter 1. We'll start there in just a few minutes if you want to be turning there. We have sufficient evidence to know that these manuscripts externally can be dated back to the first century. Now let's see what they have to say themselves. First of all, three of our six books that we are concerned with, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they all predict the destruction of Jerusalem, which took place when? 70 AD. They all predict its destruction. None of them mention it. Now, if the gospel story was made up, like atheists say, I personally would expect them to actually talk about Jerusalem being destroyed. A charlatan is going to use anything he can to gain credibility with people. If you're reading these books and they talk about Jerusalem's fall, this is the end of the Jewish nation as they would have known it, and they don't mention it, I don't know what else to conclude other than they were written before 70 AD. What if you discovered a history book about Imperial Japan and you read it? And as you read through the book and you went through the book, you go all the way through, but it does not mention the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What might you conclude about that history book?
It was written before that happened.
Okay. So we're going to use some other examples like that as we go through our study tonight. Jerusalem's destruction, by the way, was noteworthy for other reasons. Josephus says, and some people contest this figure, he says that 1.1 million Jews perished when Rome finally dropped the hammer on Judea. A significant event, not just to people like Paul, who said in the book of Romans that he still had a great love for his countrymen and he wanted them to be saved, but also for Christians of every flavor, even Gentiles like Luke, who was the number one enemy of Christianity in the first century.
The Jews.
The Romans were often the puppets and the Jews were pulling the strings. Okay? So this is the moment when our brethren in the first century are delivered from their oppressors. All right, look in Luke chapter 1. So we have three books that mention Jerusalem's destruction, and they don't talk about it. Now let's talk about Luke. We can date Luke and Acts even earlier than 70 AD. Let's say that the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and John, or at least Matthew and Mark, let's say they were written at the latest 65, 68 AD. We can date Luke even earlier than that. So in Luke chapter 1, he sets out to explain why he's writing his book and how he came about his information. Jeff mentioned the eyewitnesses in verse 2. And then in verse 3, he mentions who he's writing it for. There's a man by the name of
Theophilus.
Now, if you look in Acts chapter 1, all of this should be familiar to us if we've been through the study on Acts that is taught here periodically. This should be old hat for many of us. Acts chapter 1 and verse 1. Again, we have a reference to an audience. Who's the audience here in the text?
Theophilus.
And you'll notice that Luke says, "The first account I composed, Theophilus, about all that Jesus began to do and teach." Well, I wonder, which book would that be? Luke, right? All right, now let's talk about Acts then. In our next class, and by now you should realize that the dates I put on these lessons are completely meaningless. I'm not sticking with any of this stuff according to the dates I'd set out. In our next class, hopefully we'll talk about various things that are mentioned historically and geographically that have been confirmed within our New Testament. A few of those things will be some other events that Luke mentions in Acts that give us some key dates within the book. We know, for example, when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia. We'll talk about him a little bit more in a few minutes. If you jump all the way back to chapter 28. Yes, Acts 28. Verses 30 and 31. One of the really interesting things about Luke, he gives you a lot of information that on the surface we might think, I really don't need to know that, I'm not interested in that. He tells you about the passage of time over and over, but actually that's one of the biggest helps in all of his writings. Because if you can date this stuff, and if you know how much time passes, you start to nail down definite points in history when these events took place. And if you can be certain about that, then you can rule out a lot of objections that people raise, such as these events were recorded many years after the fact. We might say in that case they were invented, but the book is far too accurate with names and places and dates for that to be the case. You get to Acts chapter 28 and verse 30, you have another time marker, 2 full years. Which is how long Paul stayed in his quarters in Rome. And then in verse 31, you find how he's spending his time. He's preaching the kingdom of God and teaching concerning the Lord Jesus. This is about 63 AD. I'm not going to go into tonight how we nail down all the dates, because that's 45 minutes plus in and of itself. But 63 AD is confirmed by some key events that we know when they took place that he mentions in the book. And then you just count up all the other time markers like the one you have in verse 30. Now, what's interesting about that is Luke does not mention some major events that take place shortly thereafter. For example, Nero's persecution of Christians. Anybody know who Nero was?
Emperor of Rome.
He was the Roman emperor. In 64 AD, there was a great fire in the city of Rome. And nobody knows to this day exactly what caused it. Now, Tacitus, John mentioned him a little while ago, he was a little boy when the fire broke out, and he's a famous Roman historian. In his writings, he said that from the beginning, it was rumored that Nero was the one that started the fire. Now, nobody knows whether or not that's true, but at least from the beginning, there was a cloud of suspicion cast over him. So in order to divert attention elsewhere, he blamed the Christians. This was, from what I gather, a limited persecution. It was not all across the empire. It was limited perhaps just to Rome, with people being deported from Rome and perhaps other things worse than that. This was a way to get the heat off of him and blame it on others. Obviously, we know from secular history as well as our own New Testament that there were saints in Rome. We know that from Acts. We know that from the letter to the Roman brethren. And this would have definitely affected them. But Luke doesn't mention it. The second thing we have is the Jewish-Roman War, which lasts from 66 to 73 AD. Now, we know from an event we just talked about, Jerusalem's fall, this was not just a minor dust-up. This was the biggest calamity to ever befall the Jewish people in their entire history. It's worse than the slavery in Egypt. It's worse than the captivity in Babylon. When Nebuchadnezzar took them over, they lost their temple. But this time they lost their temple. They lost their priestly records. They were sold into slavery. They were slaughtered. It was terrible. They were forced to intermingle with the Gentiles. This was the complete and utter end of their nation. And the interesting thing about it is that the Gospels lay the seeds for this conflict without ever paying it off. Look, for example, at Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10. Rome conquered Judea in 63 BC by a man named Pompey. And when he conquered Jerusalem, I think over 100,000 Jews were slaughtered. And then he actually went into the temple and he went into the Holy of Holies. So he showed great disrespect to them and to their culture, and ever since then, they had a very tense relationship with the Romans overall. When you read the Gospels, you need to think of the Jews as being a conquered people. They are under occupation by people that they resent. For the most part, as you go through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the relationship between Rome and Judea is more or less simmered down. It's not as volatile as it was. But there's still some indicators that things are not great. At Matthew 10 and verse 4, you have Simon the Zealot. Can't be certain about it, according to some sources, but people are keen to point out that in the first century, the Zealots referred to a group of political zealots. They wanted to be free from Rome. They wanted their independence. They wanted to be free of Roman taxes. And they wanted people driven out of Judea that didn't belong there. So evidently Simon belonged to the same group, if that's what the name there refers to. Look at chapter 27. When we think of governors today, like the Texas governor, we think of people that are probably fairly benign overall. But when you read of the term governor in the four Gospels, you shouldn't think that way. In Matthew 27 and verse 2, you read about the Jews bounding Jesus, leading him away, and delivering him to Pilate the governor. There were at least two different kinds of governors in the first century. One of them was like Gallio in Achaia. He was a proconsul. And if you were a proconsul, you gave the people more freedom, and there was no standing army. Pilate has soldiers under his command. This is a military dictatorship in a lot of ways. So these people are occupied, and they can see the reminders of their occupation all the time. Further down in the text, Pilate, of course, finds no fault with Jesus and wants to get out of crucifying him. And in verse 24, when he sees that's not working, Matthew says he saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather that a riot was starting. And this is one of the reasons why he decides to roll over for him. He doesn't want to be the guy that lights the spark that ignites another confrontation with these people. Their occupation of Jerusalem is tenuous at best, and if things got out of hand, it could be very bad for him, especially as he is accountable to Caesar. Look at Mark chapter 15. Mark chapter 15 and verse 7. So one of the ways that Pilate tries to placate the Jews is to offer up someone else. And he thinks perhaps that they would prefer him to release Jesus rather than Barabbas. Note what Mark says about Barabbas. The man Barabbas had been imprisoned with the insurrectionist who had committed murder in the insurrection. Insurrection suggests overthrowing a civil authority, somebody who is in a position of recognized power over others. So this is not just somebody that's out rioting for riot's sake. He's trying to make political advances of some sort based on the evidence that we have in the text. In Luke chapter 23, the Jews are quite clever in their ways to manipulate Pilate. They know what he's going to respond to. And you have to remember that even though he's a man in charge and he has soldiers at his command, he's accountable to Caesar. And if Caesar doesn't like a guy, he's not going to fire him. He's going to execute him. In Luke chapter 23 and verse 1, the whole body of them got up and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." Now, do the Jews actually care about any of that, even if it's true?
No.
Not a bit. Who does care about that?
Pilate,
and especially Caesar. They say there's no such thing as bad publicity. Pilate knew better. He sure didn't want that to get back to his boss in Rome. When you look, for example, in John chapter 19, this is the lengthiest conversation we have recorded between Pilate and Jesus. And again, Pilate is just not convinced that he's worthy of death, but he's afraid. He doesn't want to be the man that has a riot on his hands, doesn't want this on his record, doesn't want to be held accountable to Caesar for letting things get out of control. In verse 12 of John 19, you read that as a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, "If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar." True enough, Rome suffered no rival. So what this also tells you about is the way that they viewed their subjects. And some of these people, like in the case of Paul, they became citizens, people that had certain privileges and rights. But others were subjects. If your subjects get out of line, you crush them beneath your boot. And you would especially be itching to do that if you felt there was competition for power somewhere in the region. When you go to Acts chapter 5, Luke mentions some other rebellions that occurred. Acts chapter 5, verse 35. This is Gamaliel speaking, and he's trying to counsel the Sanhedrin not to behave rashly toward the apostles. He said to them, "Men of Israel, take care what you propose to do with these men. For some time ago, Theudas rose up, claiming to be somebody, and a group of about 400 men joined up with him. But he was killed, and all who followed him were dispersed and came to nothing. After this man, Judas of Galilee rose up in the days of the census and drew away some people after him. He too perished, and all those who followed him were scattered." The census that he refers to in verse 37 took place about 6 AD. We don't think of a census being much of a reason to get upset, but in their day, typically when there was a census, there was also a tax. And has paying taxes ever been popular?
No.
Not by a long shot. And it sure wasn't back then, especially when they looked at these people that were occupying them as people that defiled their customs, defiled their God, even if they weren't exactly children of Abraham as they should have been. So this was all a hot-button issue for them, and you just see the seeds of this rebellion being planted all along. One final reference in Acts 17. As I said, the Jews really knew how to work and manipulate the Romans, and they knew what song they needed to play to get them to dance to their tune. In Acts 17, after they become jealous of Paul in Thessalonica, they take hold of Jason and they bring him before the city authorities in verse 6. And then they say, "These men who have upset the world have come here also, and Jason has welcomed them, and they all act contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, Jesus." That's a slanderous charge. There's just enough truth in there for there to be maybe some credibility to it. They put a spin on it to guarantee that it would arouse the ire of the Romans in their day and time. And yet again, you see the same thing. Rome's not going to suffer a rival. You better be careful about what you say. And the Jews never did want to be under Roman occupation. They finally rose up, starting in 66 A.D., The biggest loss they faced was in 70 A.D. when Jerusalem fell. There were some other skirmishes after that. And then the Great Revolt, as it was called, was ultimately suppressed in 73 A.D. Now, what if I was to read a book that recorded a history of the American colonies? And it started in the year 1763. 1763 is the year that the British won the war against the French. But they lost the peace. They started doing some really stupid stuff that irritated the colonists and eventually made them want to revolt. It starts in 1763. It goes all the way up to 1770, the Boston Massacre. And then it just stops. No mention of the Declaration of Independence, no mention of Lexington and Concord, no mention of any of that. What might I conclude? Maybe England put them down the revolution. What'd you say, Levi?
Same thing.
Okay. Another option?
The historical document recording that was written before the war.
Right. Right. So if it stops at those moments, that's as far as the author got, more than likely, because that's as far as the events themselves had gotten, especially if you're dating it back to the time in which it occurred. Now, another thing I wanted to mention to you, we talked about the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls, many of them were written long before the first century. They were collected and deposited in jars around 68 AD. by a group of Jews called the Essenes, E-S-S-E-N-E-S. You never read about them in the New Testament. They were a radical sect. They didn't believe in marriage. They practiced extreme self-denial. And these were the like somebody put it, this is the weirdo cult that saved the Bible, basically. They were destroyed when Rome sacked the city. So on Sunday, I mentioned it's a marvel that they were discovered in 1947, because in 1945, World War II had just ended. It's a marvel they survived not just 2,000 years, but it's a marvel they survived even the first century. Rome was intent on punishing these people and putting them in their place. All right, letter C, the third thing that we have here. The two most important people, the two most prominent characters in the book of Acts are Peter and Paul. Peter is the dominant character up until about chapter 10, and then after that, or chapters 10 and 11, then about chapter 12, it switches over to Paul, and he becomes the major character. Do you read about either of them dying in the book of Acts?
No.
You don't. And we can date the time of death for these two in the mid to late 60s. Now, what if I was reading a biography of JFK? Talked about his family background, talked about his religion, talked about his marriage, talked about his time in World War II, talked about his time as a senator, did not mention his death. What might I conclude?
The book was written before he died.
Written before he died. If most people know anything about JFK other than he was a president, they know that he died. His death is extremely notable and memorable. Seared in the minds of many people that weren't even alive at the time because of the Zapruder film that caught it. All right, so all these events Luke does not talk about. Now look on the bottom of page 13, number 3. It may be that of all six books that talk about the kernel of the gospel, the letter that Paul wrote to the Corinthians is possibly the oldest one. It was written somewhere in the spring of 57 AD. Look at Acts chapter 18. We can be certain of the date of this book because we know when Paul was in Corinth. We know how much time passed between his trip to Corinth, and we can harmonize his itinerary in 1 Corinthians with his travels in Acts and know when he wrote it. If you look in Acts 18 and verse 12, you read that Gallio was proconsul of Achaia. Gallio was governor of Achaia from 51 to 52 AD. It's remarkable that Luke even gets that right, because these guys only served in office for 2 years. Very high turnover. That would argue strongly against the notion that Luke just takes wild stabs in the dark and happens to get it right, if this is all made up after the fact, like skeptics say. So we know when Paul was in Corinth, 51 to 52 AD, and then, as I mentioned, the other things that we have to trace his journeys and so forth, we can arrive at the conclusion that he wrote 57 AD. Maybe some of the Gospels were written earlier. Maybe Matthew and Mark were. We don't really know, but we can at least be certain of that. And we know that Matthew, Mark, and Luke were written prior to 70 AD. We know that Luke was written before 63 AD. So that's how we can date these books. Questions or comments? All right, let's talk about their accuracy. One of the ways that we can determine, or the way to determine their accuracy, and by that I mean whether or not we have an accurate representation of what these men actually wrote 2,000 years ago, is through the abundance of the manuscripts and by comparing them with one another. This is a process called textual criticism, and this is how people date ancient texts such as these. Now, one of the things that you're likely to hear from people is that the manuscripts that we have, all of these handwritten copies of the originals, have thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of mistakes in them. True or false?
True.
It's true. It's true. Now the question is, what kind of mistakes do we have? Does one copy of Matthew say that Jesus said you make disciples by teaching them and baptizing them, and another one says you do it by invading them and conquering them?
No.
Does One copy of Luke say that Jesus was the Son of God, and another one say that he wasn't.
No.
You don't find that. But when people take a kernel of truth and warp it just enough, they can plant a seed of doubt in the hearts of others by leaving it implied that these are the kinds of glaring inconsistencies that you would find all across these thousands and thousands of manuscripts. On page 14 of the first paragraph, I mention a man named Dr. Bart Ehrman. Has anyone heard of him before? If you have anybody in your life that's a hardcore skeptic of some sort and they try to do some kind of research, they're probably going to come across his name. Bart Ehrman has a PhD from Princeton Theological Seminary. He was raised a believer, what you call a born-again Christian. And he was raised to think that the text had been reliably preserved and that it was inspired. So he decided that when he went to college, he was going to make textual criticism his specialty. And he began to study the ancient languages and the ancient manuscripts. And as he studied, he was convinced that they were full of contradictions. They were full of errors that could not be reconciled or gotten around. And for a while, he became sort of a liberal Christian, as it were. But then he began to think about the problem of evil, pain, and suffering. And if there really is a good God, as the gospel would have me believe, how could this good God let children starve in Africa and other people die of cancer when they don't deserve to? So eventually he just became an out-and-out unbeliever. A lot of times you will find his name on books that people cite, such as The Historical Jesus. Actually, I don't think that's the title of one. It's a course that he teaches for the great course. It's called The Historical Jesus. And what he presumes to set forth in that class is, let's talk about Jesus of Nazareth as he really was, and then let's talk about how all of his disciples added all these other attributes to him that he didn't really have, and how they became convinced that he was not, that he was somebody that he didn't claim to be. One of the ways that he makes his case is by pointing out that there are between 300,000 and 400,000 variants among New Testament manuscripts. Now, that's a lot, because that's about three times the number of words that are in the New Testament. You think, how is that even possible? It's because of the sheer number of manuscripts that we have. Remember what we talked about on Sunday. Of all the ancient books that we have, which one is the most well attested by manuscripts? New Testament. New Testament. Over 5,000 Greek manuscripts of it alone. And when you add up all the ancient versions and translations that we have, the number is closer to 20,000. Well, is this anything to be worried about? Look at the second paragraph, if you haven't read this already especially. By far the most significant category of variances is spelling. Doesn't that make you feel better? How many of us would be lost if we didn't have autocorrect on our cell phone? Spelling differences are the single biggest category of differences or errors in our manuscripts. For example, John, you could spell that with one N or two. If you spell it with one N in one verse in one manuscript, and then you spell it with two in the exact same verse in a different manuscript, have we lost anything? Am I suddenly forced to conclude that Mary was not a virgin? Not a bit. When you look at the percentage, it's about 75% that are spelling errors in the manuscripts. That's about 225 and 300,000 variants. That's a lot. Now, in other cases, it's different. In other cases, it involves not just the misspelling of a word, but the change of a word. So in some manuscripts, you'll find the name Jesus, and in others, they won't use that. It'll use the pronoun he or a title such as Lord or what have you. But again, none of this calls the meaning of the text into question. And none of this undermines our faith. So I have this example down toward the bottom, this quotation from Philippians. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, a verse that's familiar to all of us. What if you were to find four different manuscripts of the exact same passage, And if you have these manuscripts, and by the way, that's all you have, because how many of the originals do we have of any of these books?
None.
So we have nothing but these copies. They all say the exact same thing, but there's an error in every single one of them. What if I have exactly this scenario right here? Would it be possible for me to compare them and then to reconstruct the original text that Paul wrote? You tell me. Could you figure out what the fourth word actually was if you compared all those together? Definitely. That's exactly how they do it when they construct the manuscripts. That's exactly it. And with the superabundance of them that we have, their work is so much easier than if they had to do this for, say, the writings of Julius Caesar or any of the others that we listed on the chart that we discussed on Sunday. So in examples like these, the variations, they don't mean anything. Maybe 1% affect the meaning of a text. So let's talk about some of those. Look at 1 John chapter 1. 1 John chapter 1. And who's reading from the New King James Bible? Susan. I'm glad you eagerly volunteered over there. 1 John chapter 1 and verse 4. I'd like you to read that one. These things we write to you that your joy may be full. Now let's talk about the New American Standard. These things we write so that our joy may be full. Ah! We'll just throw the whole thing in the trash. Does that change anything?
No.
It does change something, but does it make the difference between heaven and hell? Have it just destroyed whether or not baptism is necessary to salvation? What have we lost? If you have these kinds of differences, and they do exist in the manuscripts. Anything? Not a bit. Look at Mark chapter 9. So many more things I wanted to mention, but I'm just going to skip it for the sake of time. I do want to say this. I've not been arguing for the truth of the resurrection from inspiration. I haven't made that argument. But I want to just make you think about this. When we say that the Bible is inspired, we do not mean that it's been copied 100% accurately for 2,000 years. That's obviously not the case. You have spelling differences. You have people that put words in the wrong order sometimes. It happens. When we talk about inspiration, and we talk about a document being completely free of errors, we're talking about the originals. But we don't have them. That's okay. Because I can still find out what God's will is for me, and I can still find out what He did for me on the cross by looking at the copies and comparing them to one another. So look at Mark chapter 9 and verse 49. King James Bible, Sally, can you read verse 49?
Shall be salted with fire, and every sacrifice shall be salted with salt.
If you have the New American Standard Bible, does it say the exact same thing?
No.
That's a little bit shorter. Everyone will be salted with fire. What does this change? I say nothing, because either way, I don't know what he's talking about. Nothing has been lost, okay? You don't find any major central doctrine of Christianity being threatened. You will not find that in the differences in manuscripts. So how did Bart Ehrman get to where he is? I don't know. I can't explain that. Another thing about this, we have all these thousands of manuscripts. There's thousands and thousands of errors scattered across them. What that does tell you is that there was not a conspiracy to make one official Bible. There was not a conspiracy to gather certain books together by a group of people in a dark room somewhere and decide which books go in and which books go out. If that was true, they did a terrible job. Because the documentation we have in the manuscripts says that did not happen, at least not successfully. And one thing I do know, even with the errors that come with copiers and the natural mistakes of human error that you just can't get around, these books were still regarded as the source of ultimate truth concerning Jesus. I know that because of all the quotations that we mentioned a moment ago from the early church writings. And as we said, no major doctrines, no major facts are threatened by any of these. All right, so we've got just a few minutes left. The major takeaway in all this on page 15, here's what this doesn't prove. And I stress this because sometimes people make this argument, and I know they mean well, but they're wrong. How do you know you can believe the Bible? Well, because of the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Septuagint, and the manuscripts. That's not how I know I can believe it. All those things tell me is, I know I can believe that what they say is actually what was written. That's all they tell me. They don't tell me that the text is true, they just tell me that I have a true text. Do I have what Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Paul wrote? Yes. I've got that. Now, if I know that I've got that, and I know what they say, which we've already discussed in the kernel of the gospel, I can go from there. And I can submit the rest of their writings to various tests, which we want to do on Sunday when we talk about the historical and geographical accuracy of the manuscripts. If you look on page 16, embarrassingly, I shortchanged Luke. There are so many more examples that we could appeal to. And if we have time, I may work a few more into the class discussion on Sunday. If you haven't read the two quotes that I have for you on page 17, read those. It will be a comfort to your faith if you've not already given us some thought and reflection. All right, that's it for us tonight. Thank you for your attention.